As technologies and geopolitics change, so does the nature of warfare. Welcome back to On Future War, a series sponsored by Cubic Defense that looks at emerging technologies and how they may affect peer and near-peer level conflict in the future, particularly in the Indo-Pacific region, with a specific focus on military tactics, operations, and strategy, and their interaction with the other instruments of national security policy. The future is now.
The United States of America was suddenly and deliberately attacked by naval and air forces of the Empire of Japan.
Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
The people who knocked these buildings down will hear all of it soon.
Each of our three major state threats in the U.S. Indo-PACOM area of responsibility, the People's Republic of China, Russia, and the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, are taking unprecedented actions that challenge international norms and advance authoritarianism. These adversarial regimes are increasingly interconnected, which is evident in Xi and Putin's declaration of a no-limits friendship, as well as Kim Jong-un's material deliveries to Putin in support of the illegal invasion of Ukraine. Nevertheless, the PRC is the only country that has the capability, capacity, and intent to upend the international order. Even amid slowing economic growth, the PRC continues its aggressive military buildup, modernization, and coercive gray zone operations. All indications point to the PLA meeting President Xi Jinping's directive to be ready to invade Taiwan by 2027. The PLA's actions indicate their ability to meet Xi's preferred timeline to unify Taiwan with mainland China by force, if directed. Admiral John C. Aquilino, Commander, U.S. Indo-Pacific Command, in a statement to the U.S. Congress House Armed Services Committee on March 20, 2024. The United States Indo-PACOM is one of six geographic commands as defined by the DoD's Unified Command Plan. As a geographic combatant command, Indo-PACOM is in charge of using and integrating United States Army, Navy, Air Force, and Marine forces within their AOR to achieve U.S. national security objectives while protecting national interests. The Indo-PACOM AOR covers more of the globe than any of the other geographic commanders and shares borders with all of the other five. This series on future war was born of a recognition that after two decades of counterinsurgency and unconventional warfare taking center stage in American politics, media, and the public consciousness, there is an urgent demand to refocus military, political, and public discourse on near-peer threats to our nation. At Authentic, we endeavor to deliver thoughtful and insightful content through discussion with industry experts encompassing not only military strategy, but also other critical elements of national security, such as technology, economics, and public policy. Our partners in this series, Cubic Defense, also believe in this thought leadership. The discussion of these timely and, frankly, to some frightening scenarios, we feel, is critical to the vigilance necessary to remain a strong and prepared nation. Our partners like Cubic encourage these discussions, inspiring us to dig deeper and talk plainly about the challenges we face. We thank Cubic for this support and hope the series is providing you, our listener, with material that is engaging, informative, and thought-provoking. Thank you for listening. This is Authentic.
Welcome to On Future War, a series of discussions on the critical issues around peer-level conflict in the near future and beyond, with a focus on the Indo-Pacific region. I'm your host, Mike Benitez, and in case you missed it, Last episode, we talked about the unsinkable carriers in the Pacific, that is the man-made islands in China. And at the end of that episode, we actually alluded to this topic. I'm really excited, looking forward to talking about this today. And the topic we're going to talk about today is mobility in the littorals. Specifically, one of the parts of the discussion we're going to dwell on quite a bit today has been pretty controversial with a lot of retired senior leaders from the Marine Corps. So to help me out today, I'm an Air Force guy. And we're talking about non-Air Force stuff. And so I'm joined by my co-host slash guest today. He's going to be speaking from the Navy side of it is Scott Roger Chafian. He brings a wealth of knowledge from the surface warfare community. And he's done that for a long, long, long time. And he's a history buff like me. So welcome back, Roger.
Thanks, Paco.
And neither of us have the level of experience, insights, or expertise to talk incredibly about the Marine Corps operating in the littoral regions, but we have someone who does. And so our special guest today is Marine Corps Colonel Lance Boyle Lewis. Welcome, Lance.
Thanks so much, Bago. Hi, Roger.
Good to see you.
This is a really controversial topic, and you might think, Boyle, he's got a F-18 background. So he's actually a fighter pilot. And so you might think, why are we bringing a Marine fighter pilot on to talk about mobility in the littorals? Yeah, all Marines are riflemen, but Lance has a specific set of skills and background that allows him to speak credibly upon this. So Lance, why don't you just give us a quick rundown of your background just to kind of set the stage before we dive into it?
Sure. So, you know, taking it way back, I'm a Navy brat who went to the Air Force Academy and then joined the Marine Corps. So I've got joint qualification baked into my blood. And then, as you mentioned, Paco, yep, went F-18s after flight school, did two carrier deployments. I did a FAC tour with 1st Battalion, 2nd Marines, 5 total combat deployments. So every deployment I've done has been to the Middle East, whether it be on the ship, flying out of Kuwait, flying out of Al-Assad, fighting on the ground in Iraq, flying over Afghanistan. And then I had 05 command in Japan from 12 to 14. So we're there on the kind of cusp of, you know, Obama's pivot to the Pacific. Did a lot of flying out there and then, you know, various staff jobs, war college. And then really it was in 2019, I took command of Marine Corps Air Station Iwakuni, mainland Japan. So for 3 years, from 19 to 22. And that was when Force Design, and I know we'll talk about that, that's when it was first unveiled. And so really living it out there in the Pacific as the Marine Corps was reshaping itself and then operating out of the Pacific for 5 years out of the last decade, I think gives me some unique perspective. Experience from being out there.
Awesome. What a great intro. By the way, someone told me that you are very, very close to completing a PhD in history.
Yes, that is correct. So, you know, about ready to give dissertation back to my advisors after getting their first, you know, kind of set of chops here at the end state through the Royal Military College up in Canada in war studies.
Wow. So a preemptive congratulations, hopefully not to
thank you.
Not to spoil it.
Yeah, very much so.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, knocking on wood right now.
All right. So we've set the stage with credentials, which is very, very important for this conversation because this is we're going to talk about one of the largest structural changes in arguably the entire history of the Marine Corps. And so you alluded to it, Force Design. Force Design 2030, I think, is the full bumper sticker when it was unveiled. Can you talk about like where it started? How did that come from? Like the genesis, it didn't just fall out of like, you know, thin air. Like it sounded like it was a very well thought out, rigorously studied, purposeful decision to change the entire direction of the Marine Corps.
Yeah, you're exactly right, Parker. I mean, this is sweeping sea change in the United States Marine Corps. You know, I've been in nearly 28 years. I've never seen any kind of massive change like this, whether it be in a single service, Marine Corps, or any service, really, for that matter. So it began really back in 2012. And I alluded to kind of during my intro, you know, President Obama, the pivot to the Pacific as we start shifting our focus into the Indo-PACOM region. And really, General Amos, when he was commandant at the time, all the way to the current commandant, General Smith, they all said successively, look, we are not man-trained or equipped to fight a peer or near-peer threat. Especially if we're going to think about who our peer adversary in the Pacific would be, the People's Republic of China. And then each successive commandant said that, but we were obviously involved in Afghanistan and Iraq. And so that was the current fight. But there was always this thought in the back of our minds as a service, okay, where are we going to go in the future? Yes, we're fighting counterinsurgency now, but
And it was really when General Berger, in his lead up to becoming commandant in 2019, where he took a lot of very smart folks in the Marine Corps, outside the Marine Corps, and really took a look at, okay, what is the threat as we wind down the campaigns in Afghanistan and Iraq, kind of finish those operations there. What is it the Marine Corps is going to be asked to do? The National Defense Strategy changed in 2019 with a clear focus on China, Russia, you know, whereas global terrorism has kind of been at the front first. A lot of analytical rigor went into it, a lot of wargaming, IPTs, analysis, experimentation, real huge body of evidence for, okay, what do we, you know, what is the value proposition of the Marine Corps as a service in a fight in the Pacific specifically against a peer threat of China? Do we have the equipment now? Are we organized the right way? Do we have the command and control that we need for that kind of adversary or that kind of fight? And so that was the genesis. So real analytical rigor. And that culminated in, when General Berger became commandant, his planning guidance, Force Design 2030.
Yeah, and it's really easy to organize, train, equip, and prepare for the last war, because it's very easy to compare metrics to success because it's already happened. You know, we can just do that a little bit better, this a little bit better. It's fundamentally a different problem when you're walking in the dark and you don't know where the path is. And there's a lot of trying to predict the future and make some hedge bets. And we might get to this a little bit later, but no branch of the military fights on its own. So it has interdependencies. And so it gets wicked complex when one service tries to make a change and it has second, third order effects across the entire joint force. But when the entire Marine Corps is making really big moves, those have to be well understood, well communicated, and well thought out, because some of these are one-way decisions. And when you start slaughtering sacred cows, those are one-way decisions. So the first one, there's a few that jump out at me. The first one, I think when Force Design 2030 came out, people were like, wow, this is great. And then everyone was like, okay, you know, all right, you know, we'll see what happens. And then the first cut came and everyone just lost their mind. I get started with the tanks. He's like, the tanks are gone. We're getting rid of the tanks. And everyone's like, oh, you know, when's that going to happen? It's like, now, right now. Like, oh man, this is real.
That's right. So yes, so there were some cuts. You know, we did significant restructuring, and it was really, hey, we need to divest. You know, one of the conclusions was we need to divest ourselves of legacy equipment, tanks being one of them. We could talk about why, you know, the rationale behind that. And I know we'll get into, you know, some other structural changes that were made. And you brought up a great point there, Paco, about the joint force. This wasn't the Marine Corps thing. Like, how are we by ourselves going to fight? Because the Marine Corps, we are the smallest service. And these are my own words, is to, when there's a crisis around the world, you send the Marines in. We're there first with the Navy, right? We're forward deployed all the time. We go in first. We punch people in the nose. We grab onto their leg like a scrappy dog, and we bite their shin. And we look over our shoulder and we hope to God our big brother, the Army and the Air Force, are behind us, getting ready to wallop them on top of the head. And so, a very crude concept, but that's basically, that's how the Marine Corps works. And so, again, this force design wasn't just, how is the Marine Corps on its own going to fight? How do we enable the entire joint force and our allies in a future fight? Not a past fight, like you said, Parker, but in a future.
One of the things you mentioned, just to take a side cart into Roger's lane for just a second. So you talked about, hey, the Navy's going to get us where we got to go. They're going to be forward with us. It's a little nuance that most people, I don't think, understand. You think of like the Navy, you think of destroyers and aircraft carriers. There's actually like almost a Navy within a Navy. It's a very purpose-built Navy. I think a lot of us call it like the Gator Navy because it has some amphibious components. And that's really the part of the Navy that exists to support the Marine Corps. And it has its own requirements for how many ships and how many types of ships and based on rotational forces and how the size of the Marine Corps is. And so as the Marine Corps changes, that part of the Navy has to change and adapt to support the Marine Corps, right?
That's right. But I would almost flip that on its head. You know, the Marine Corps is there to support the naval campaign. You know, that is what's in Title 10. That is our top line mission that every service in Title 10 has, hey, here's what Congress has said, here's what you're supposed to do. Such a National Security Act, 47, and then updated in 52 for the Marine Corps was seize and defend advanced naval bases in support of the naval campaign. And so we see ourselves as enabling the naval campaign. through our force design changes. But you're absolutely right, Pog, but that also requires changes in the Navy as well.
I remember I was in the Marine Corps in the late 90s and I got out in 2005. And I was in Afghanistan in 2001 when we did the airfield seizure from the USS Bataan and 26 Mute up to Kandahar. You know, we're 800 miles or something like that, 900 miles from the ship at one point. And we're like, I don't see any ocean around here. This is, we're not supposed to be here. We are not organized, trained, and equipped to be a land-faring force. But then, you know, we adapted because we stayed there for a long, long, long time, a generation, as it turns out. And so the Marine Corps slowly turned itself into a different kind of army, almost, where it was using ships to go places, but it would get off the ships and then you'd stay on land and do your thing. And then, you know, the Air Force would fly you back and forth. But before, so we back up just a little bit. I'm just completely out of order. So before that, in the 90s, when it was very much, you know, superpower coming through, USA, world peace broken out, the Marine Corps pivoted from the Cold War, which was an amphibious force, to an expeditionary force. So it still did the rotations, deployments, but now it got special qualifications so it could do things like NEOs, so your embassy evacuations and humanitarian aid and things like that. So it was organized and it actually has transformed a few times over its generations. But this is probably the one that's the biggest one because you're really like restructuring not only the equipment, but entirely new units and not just like, you know, battalions, new regiments, new doctrine, new operating concepts, like everything is all changing at the same time, which is a very, very tricky to pull off without missing a beat. And we'll get to that in just a second. But so we talked about the tanks. The other thing, the other sacred cow that got slaughtered would just set everyone over the top from the peanut gallery or the bleachers. Sorry for the retired folks that are listening that were on one side of the fence or the other. But when the Marine Corps decided, like, hey, based on our analysis, artillery is out, rockets are in. And that set off your 777s, your howitzer units, when those were going to get cut. I think the original plan was like cut 75% of them and then triple the amount of rocket units that the Marine Corps was going to field. Does that sound about right?
I think so for the original. And now it's settled on kind of a 50-50. And force design has been like that, where, you know, just like when you go to the rifle range, you make aggressive corrections at the beginning and then you fine tune. And we have done that throughout, although we have gotten rid of some of our, heavy engineer equipment, bridging equipment. We did get rid of tanks, but some of the other things where we thought, you know, like the artillery example, hey, we're going to cut X amount and then build this much, you know, long range rocket force. And then as we refine those and we actually do exercises now, we go, okay, you know what? Actually, we're going to fine tune this. And there's a continual fine tuning. As you do it more, as you're actually fielding equipment, you know, the best thing you can do is obviously have a body of analysis behind what you're changing, but you give it to a Lance Corporal and you go, hey man, how's this work? And you go up against a live, breathing, thinking op for a red force out there. How did this turn out? What were the pros and cons of it? Some things have worked better. Some things have worked. You know what? We need to tweak what that structure is, what that command and control is. And so it's a living, breathing process.
Yeah, I saw artillery and HIMARS used extensively in Afghanistan over the years. I did multiple deployments there as well. And you know, flying around most of them, one on the ground, a couple in the air. And it was interesting to see the difference. You know, if you're in artillery range and the artillery goes hot, here's the max ord. And they just, you know, they're laying down artillery. It's like, wow, you can see it. You can see it going off. And in the HIMARS, it was really interesting because it could reach out and touch places, but the coordination in multi-domain operations, you know, we call them goalposts going active. These things would shoot up to like 100,000 feet, you know, go over and then come back down and hit the earth. And the amount of coordination it required, like some of these were, you know, an hour of deconfliction to get one shot off. And the interesting part was like, the closer it was to the HIMARS site, the harder it was to coordinate because the rocket had to go basically straight up over just a little bit, straight back down. And so when you got inside of artillery range, the HIMARS actually was a kind of a pain to operate. And I would imagine your cost per effect goes down considerably. And your kill chain obviously is starting to get a little bit bloated at that point. So the layered force strategy is typically, no surprise, a layered approach is generally the best approach. Mm-hmm. So
that's
so
right.
I'm glad they started looking at that. And I don't know if anything that kicked off in Ukraine, you know, has helped shape that, because there's a lot of artillery flying in Ukraine. Turns out they're both HIMARS and artillery are pretty needed.
That's right. So like you said, that layered approach is probably the best way to go.
With the HIMARS, there was a concept called HIRAIN. I don't know if they still call it that. That was they deploy the HIMARS with the Marine Corps doing their expeditionary advanced base operations. It's their other new concept, EABO, to move these HIMARS around on the dirt strips and islands using C-130s. They're basically shoot and scoot, which is a really good way to hold a lot of targets at risk with the minimal logistic footprint.
Yeah, that's right. So I saw that kind of from conception to actually in reality while I was out there in Japan in command 19 to 22. You know, you experiment with those things. Can we do that? That's been publicized. But that shoot and scoot concept was another part of force design. And why are we restructuring? We're going to have a large formation and be static. That is probably a terrible way of going about business these days.
Yeah. I remember back in 10 years now, 15 years almost. Man, yeah. We would do that out at Nellis on the Nellis Range. We would bring the Marine Corps out in C-130s. We dirt strip landings and we'd time, put the HIMARS out the back. It gets powered up. It gets a fix from the C-130's nav system to figure out where it's at. You'd shoot and then you'd get it all back up on the airplane. It wouldn't even shut the airplane down. So it's...
That's right.
Yeah, what's old is new again, right?
That's right. Yeah.
One of the things I really like about the decision, and there's been a lot of initiatives and quote strategies and plans from the services over the years as they're trying to modernize. The Marine Corps is the only one that I know of that says we're going to do it and then we're going to grade our homework in public with these annual updates. And it is very detailed. By this date, this will happen. By this date, this will happen. It is broken down on different themes and sections and who's in it. I could imagine, retired Air Force guy, I could imagine if the Air Force tried to do that with that level of detail and, you know, public view, trying to change itself and holding itself publicly accountable. That takes a lot of guts. That's leadership.
Well, it is. And I think any of the services could do it. You know, probably the best structured for it, and I hate to say this publicly, is the U.S. Army. You know, they're really, really good at moving a large organization one direction. But like you said, Pago, it takes, you know, a service chief to say, hey, we're going full right rudder, reverse starboard engine, and this is the direction we're going. You know, as a Marine Corps, we are very different. Obviously, our service culture is different. When our commandant says, this is what you're doing, then we salute, and that's what we do. Yes, there is debate, but it's always in an atmosphere of being open for feedback. Once we build that evidence of like, wow, that did not work at all, or that worked great, or we need to tweak this one particular thing, that we are going to do that. You know, being a small service, we're able to do those kinds of things. Certainly, I think any of the services could do what the Marine Corps is doing right now.
Well, I will say that there's another aspect of change that I think the Marine Corps has done a very good job at, and that is getting congressional buy-in. Changing anything in any of the services, they're all sacred cows. Every piece of equipment is a sacred cow to someone. And the amount of change over time and large swaths of change, not just like, hey, we're going to get rid of a couple tanks, but we're going to get rid of all the tanks. It took a lot, I'm sure, a lot of meetings on the Hill and behind closed doors. Here's the analysis. Here's why. And I want to say wheeling and dealing, but just honest conversations and transparency. Here's the data. Here's why we're doing it. And if we don't, here's, you know, cost benefit analysis. The other services, when they try to do that, my experience, I used to work up there, they would try to do something. And instead of getting support, it would either be you're blocked, so there's language that says you can't retire any tanks, or they would come out and say, hey, within 120 days of this authorization, the Marine Corps deliver me this 500-page report with all your analysis of why you want to get rid of tanks, and then we'll think about it. And then you basically put the report language in, and you kick the decisions down for a couple of years. People turn over, and it's a way to stonewall change. And so the fact that Marine Corps didn't have really any of that, they were allowed to make these changes. It wasn't just, you know, a flippant change. Like, you know, woke up one day and said, you know what, tanks, nah, they're not cool anymore. Let's get rid of them.
That's right.
So I don't think a lot of people who haven't lived inside the Beltway or the Pentagon and Congress, like how the process of these things happen, very, very well thought out. Whether it's right or wrong, that's an opinion. But the fact is, like, they're, you know, it's well researched, well documented, and well solicited across the river to the Hill. So.
Well, I think it speaks to the body of evidence that exists for this is what, not just the Marine Corps, but how the joint force thinks we are going to fight. And in order to do that, meet military objectives, political leaders would want us to achieve, this is the kind of structure that we absolutely must have. And these are the changes we need to start making time now, not later. And to have that body of evidence, as we said, wargaming, IPTs, modeling and simulation, exercises, to back all that up, to have it be nearly universally accepted, I mean, just really speaks to the volume of research and analysis that went into this.
So we're talking about force design. So changing the Marine Corps, you know, for what, I guess, is probably the next segue. So all this change is needed. What does the Marine Corps think that littoral combat is going to look like in that 2030 timeframe? Because obviously that's the North Star that it's shooting for.
Marine Littoral Regiment, the first one was the 3rd Marine Littoral Regiment, stood up in Hawaii, I think early 2022. You know, your standard Marine regiment is made of 3 infantry battalions. You know, that's your basic, like 2nd Marine Regiment, part of 1st Battalion, 2nd Marine Regiment. We had 3 battalions that are ready. This are 3 elements inside the MLR. You have your littoral combat team. So think infantry-based as well, but a small disaggregate force that can operate the Nemesis system. So the Navy Marine Corps Expeditionary Ship Interdiction System. So any ship missiles that can be deployed and moved around easily on a unmanned vehicle, JLTV, as it moves around the battle space and does sea denial. Supporting the logistics combat teams, you have your littoral anti-air battery, and they're doing a host of things. So something that was not really resident inside of a regiment, they're doing air surveillance, air control, and air defense for the entire MLR. And again, disaggregated across particular AO. The other thing the littoral anti-air battalion will do is also be responsible for setting up and supporting FOBs and FARPs, so forward aerial refueling points and forward operating bases. So you think about moving aviation assets in, needing rearming or refueling. But again, this was a capability that was not resident in a traditional Marine regiment. So totally new skill set being brought into a regiment. And then lastly, you have your littoral logistics battalion, who is responsible for the logistics aspects of supporting both the anti-air battalion and then the littoral combat team. Over top of that, you have the Marine Littoral Regiment headquarters, who does the command and control. And then they're either controlled by a division or the MEF itself.
And you mentioned the Nemesis, by the way, good acronym.
That's right.
let's talk for a minute about that, because it's a very interesting capability that I don't think gets a whole lot of attention. And it's not, it's all public. You can Google it. So
that's
the
right.
Nemesis, it has basically 2 components, if I remember right. It has the Rogue Fires, which is the unmanned launcher, which is basically a GTLV platform, I think, with your launcher tubes.
That's right.
And then the actual effector is the other one that's really interesting. So the naval strike missile moving to the joint strike missile, so NSM to the JSM. So the interesting part, when you move to the JSM, that is actually compatible and designed to fit inside an F-35. So now you're looking at the Marine Corps has F-35s. They have ground launchers for these maritime strike weapons that can also be guided and launched and directed by F-35. So there's a little bit of their own, I don't say long range, but somewhat long range kill chain that's organic to the Marine Corps and really to those MLRs. They have their organic fires and organic sensing capabilities, which is pretty new, distributing it down to that level. Usually it's up, coordinating across multiple battalions, regiments, you know, different types of structures, where it's your, like an air wing to an infantry battalion and things like that. So putting it all together in these kind of packets of capability and pushing them forward is really, when I look at that, that's what I think of.
Yeah. So we talked about, you know, Mission Marine Corps, seasoned, defended, key maritime terrain in support of a advanced naval bases for the naval campaign. You know, that's key maritime terrain. And in the Pacific, there's loads of key maritime terrain. You just need to look at a map, and there's all kinds of straits and key waterways that are there that you can hold at risk by seizing that kind of territory. Thing too is, when you think about the MLR, specifically in the First Island Chain, as part of the standard force, and then you look at what's happening around the world with Ukraine or even in Israel, and you think GPS denied environment, C2 degraded environment, all kinds of degradations that could happen. You know, who is best postured to sense targets and hold targets at risk? Is it somebody from far away, you know, from outside, where it's hard to kind of pierce that degraded environment? Or is it somebody who's actually standing there inside that threat Wes, who can actually sense inside of that kind of clutter. And then, as you talked about, Pog, you know, pretty unique capability the Marine Corps has never had before, you know, the ability to sink ships. But is that really the most important thing? Yes, it can, or perhaps is the most important thing, be able to sense, make sense of the battlefield, hold targets at risk, and then provide that information back to the joint force. And now that joint force commander has a more options available to him or her when they're deciding, okay, how am I going to engage a particular target set? Is it with my standard forces right there right now, or does it make more sense to bring in another kind of package where the air, maritime, surface, subsurface, all domain, whatever happened to be to get the effect that they want? But that sensing and that SA is coming from that MLR with that sensors that you talked about already, and then being able to pass that back to the joint.
Yeah, boy, you made a great point. I notice you're speaking in rhetorical questions, you know, that's actually a good thing. And I was, it reminds me of a conversation I had recently. It was about modernizing the military and why things are hard and everything. And one of the things I discussed was the offset strategies. So you have the first offset, mm-hmm. the second offset, the third offset. And the third offset strategy, the easiest way that I can explain it, if you ignore all the capabilities and AI and all that other stuff, just throw all that away. If you could boil it down, the second offset was about having exquisite solutions for each problem. There's a problem, I'm going to break it down and develop exquisite offset for that problem. In the third offset, it's about creating multiple dilemmas for the adversary. And what that means is you have to have multiple solutions to every problem to create the multiple dilemmas for the enemy. So you have optionality for the commanders. And so, boy, when you're talking about, I can do this or maybe that, it's not definitive because it's options on the table. So that is purposeful, that the way that you're saying that, just that you're not obfuscating, you're being very purposeful in what you're saying.
Well, it's the difference between a kill chain and a kill web, right? A kill chain is, I'm a forward air controller, I see the enemy, I get on my radio, I call Paco up in his airplane, and I say, hey man, here's the target, and then you hit it. But if any part of that chain breaks, the whole thing falls apart. You're not there, my radio breaks, I can't see it for whatever reason. But a kill web is, I have multiple sensors that are passed to multiple people, and multiple folks can command and control whatever that happens to be. And it doesn't matter if you remove one or many parts of that, we can still get effects on a particular target.
So we've been saying everything is rainbows and unicorns. Everything is great. Every step of the way was the right decision. It was completely obvious to everyone. Everyone is complaining about it. You guys have lost your minds. But obviously, it's way more nuanced than that. And so there's always there's an opportunity cost if you don't do something, and there's always a cost if you do execute something. And so taking a page out of the naysayers that are resisting a lot of this change, they would argue that you are preparing for the most dangerous course of action by sacrificing readiness for the most likely course of action. How would you characterize that?
I could see why people would say that, because it's so heavily focused on one particular theater and one particular threat. If you just kind of take a step back from that aspect, you can see where this kind of concept would be very useful in, you know, modern war. If you look at just what Ukraine and Russia are doing, you know, it's my own personal opinion, but I'm sure the Ukrainians wish, boy, I wish we had a small, agile element that could operate inside of our threats WES and be able to communicate through all of this GPS clutter, all of this comm clutter, all of this jamming that we're getting, all this EW interference that we're getting, purposeful, that's targeted at us. Now everybody has to stand off at distance. Wouldn't it be great if we could somehow maneuver inside of all of that? And this potentially, you know, offers, is it the solution? No, nothing is the solution. But it is certainly a solution. You can see where it can apply a lot of different places, especially as, you know, you look what's happening around the world. So yes, we are measuring ourselves against who we think is the greatest threat with the most capable potential adversary out there. And that's a good way to measure. We know what that is. We can objectively measure that. And then if we can do that, then gosh, we can do darn near anything after that.
Let's pivot just a little bit. You mentioned Title 10 authorities and responsibilities earlier. One of the things that, as a career, you know, active duty guy myself, OTE, Organized Train Equip, is a foundational Title 10 responsibility for the services to include the Marine Corps within the Department of the Navy. So when you think about organized, train, and equip, you know, I've been reading a lot lately about different force structures and how they failed. It was a book, some books of failure. And if I could sum it up, it was always one or more of a combination of organized, train, and equip. And if you didn't have all three, you were almost destined for failure at some point. And the book I'm reading right now, it goes case by case, and it's just a really good book. But one of the case studies I was reading was a military that was trying to modernize itself, and it basically tried to jump horses, and it just timed it wrong. So it was trying to do everything right. The timing was wrong based on the geopolitical environment, and then a war kicked off when they were, you know, midstream of reorganizing. Yeah, so they weren't organized, trained, or equipped because they did all the right things at all the right, but just wrong time. I'm not sure there's a way to minimize that risk. You either rip the Band-Aid off and get it over with now or never, or you do it, you know, inch by inch, anything's a cinch. So as I tell my kids, so as the MLR is rapidly transforming, you know, organized, trained, equipped, they're organized, you know, they have a name, they have a commander, there's an activation ceremony. I would argue they're not quite yet equipped. And then you really have to have the equipped to then do the training. Can you give us your thoughts on that or update? How is it going?
You're exactly right. You know, when's a good time to completely change your service? There is never a good time, right? There's stuff going on all over the world all the time. Some of, I think, Forces Idle was, hey, man, we're just ripping the Band-Aid off. We're going to go now. We're going to get rid of tanks. Well, when's that going to happen? Today. You know, if you want to drive a tank tomorrow, you're going to be too late. And so I think, philosophically, I think part of Forces I was at, we need to start now and it needs to be rapid. For the MLR specifically, I think we were pretty deliberate with choosing where is it going to happen. You know, we didn't pick 12th MLR in Okinawa. Why? Because we need organized, trained, and equipped forces ready to go at a moment's notice inside the first island all the time. So we're going to start with 3rd MLR in Hawaii. Yes, it's still part of 3MEF. However, they're a little closer to the states, and as we stand them up, like you said, we had a big stand-up ceremony, but then they can get their equipment from the states, they can train with it there in the states, we can do exercises, wargaming, we can take their commander. You know, as we're building this unit, we can take them through the growing pains in a it's-okay-to-fail environment out at 29 Palms or at Camp Pendleton or there at the Y training ranges. And as 3rd MLR, we kind of shake out what those growing pains are. And it's everything from, hey, what MOS is, you know, it's everything from top to bottom. Hey, what does the command element look like? How many rifles do we have? Where are we going to put everybody? How do we command and control? How do I talk to my folks? You know, here I've been brought up as a, you know, I'm an infantry guy. I've been brought up in the regular battalion my whole life. What do you mean I'm going to disaggregate? How does that work mentally? How do I command and control that? How do I get through those kind of emotional growing pains for everybody, not just the physical ones that you talked about. And so we got to get 3rd MLR on its feet with its equipment, you know, its full organization, learn from that. And we tweak things as we're going through, and then we shift gears to 12th MLR. And now we can hand them the lessons. Is the wheel perfectly round right now? Probably not, but pretty round. And we know what it needs to look like now. And then we go and we exercise. We don't just say, stand it up. Here's your new flag. Everybody put new stickers on the back of your car. No, we got to go out. We got to try this stuff. We got to train just like a squatter does. You know, you're always training all the time. And even if the weapons, the airplane, the people are the same, you're always tweaking, making modifications to things all the time to make yourselves better.
You mentioned the purposeful or not, the 3rd MLR is activating Hawaii, which is co-located with the very first Marine Corps MQ-9 squadron. Coincidence?
That's right. You know, that's like the books. Coincidence? I think not. Again, with MQ-9 as the Marine Corps, I think some of that was, you know, some good timing of Marine Corps. You know, we've been involved with VMU, our unmanned squadrons for, gosh, over a decade now. And those platforms have changed as we've gone through Blackjack all the way up now to MQ-9s. And it's really, really being able to shed our old gear, you know, which is hard to do. You, especially as a Marine, you never want to let go of gear. Why? Because we've stolen it from somebody, probably the Army,
And so we took
all the hand-me-downs.
We're going to hang on to this for 50 years, you know? But knowing, like, hey, man, we need to put the MQ-9 there. It's a little easier to put it in a state of the United States, in Hawaii, than it is to push it into an allied nation, Japan, or moving them down to Australia. You know, you have to work with your ally about that. Why? Because they have different rules. They have different flavor of FAA. There's a whole host of challenges and bureaucracy you need to get through to make those things happen. But once you prove to your ally, hey, this works, this is why we're doing it, then it makes it a little easier to push those kind of assets.
Yeah, the Air Force operates, obviously, MQ-9s. They have some that are stationed in Europe. And I think there's definitely some scar tissue based on your host nation, when you can fly, where you can fly, and where you can't fly, and then what you can carry on when you fly, where you fly. So everything is run through the host nation. So it becomes incredibly difficult to do some of the things that you're being asked to do when your host nation is not always supportive for various reasons, you know, right or wrong, or it is what it is. So
that's right. It's their nation, right? They get to decide.
They're the host.
Yeah, they're the host. Oh, we have a great relationship with them. I would submit, like the U.S. and Japan, you show them the value of it. These are the operating concepts. And maybe, that you know, like the Japanese, they are buying their own MQ-9s. And they want to learn. You know, the U.S. has been flying UASs for decades now, safely, effectively, efficiently, with all kinds of different payloads, like you mentioned, all very, very safe. You know, we've got a huge body of evidence that says, hey, you can do this safely, even with, you know, in high traffic manned chunks of airspace like Afghanistan, right? You've got coming out of Kabul, you've got, I remember I diverted in there once and I'm sitting there at the hold short and there's some F-16s and some A-10s and an MQ-9 and then Marine F-18s on the side of him and everybody's just, and it was like, no big deal. It's just another aircraft.
You obviously have never had a near midair with one over the skies of Afghanistan.
I have actually over the skies of Afghanistan. That's not to dissuade any ally out there about how good.
Yeah. We're poking a little bit of fun. But the peak of Afghanistan was the air congestion was insane. So
that's right.
Big sky theory only works when there's not 1,000 things in the sky.
That's right.
Turns out. So we mentioned the Marine Corps transforming. We talked at the very beginning about how, you know, nothing happens in a bubble and there's other dependencies and you have to manage that change across all of the services. And so if the Army and the Marine Corps said, you know what, tanks, not cool, we're getting rid of them. Like, whoa. Like, we actually do need tanks across the Department of Defense. So I think because the Marine Corps is smaller and more focused on its mission, it's a very narrowly focused mission that allows you to have that freedom of force maneuverability as far as organized training and equip that I don't think some of the other services have, because they have, you know, 10 or 15 Title 10 missions that they're they're in charge of, and you make one change over here and it impacts, you know, all these other things. And so when I look at the Air Force, when we go through the services, I'll start with the Air Force. EBAO, or Expeditionary
Advanced Base Operation.
So when you read the description, if you just ignore if you took the title away and you took the service away and you read the description, I would say it's almost verbatim the description of the Air Force's ACE concept. They're literally copy and paste the same kind of concepts, which is whether it's a hub and spoke design or something, but it's forward men logistics, disaggregation of forces as a stand-in force to either act as a contact layer or a blunt layer for episodic moment of time to do something. And it's coordinated with all these other things that are kind of moving around. It's not meant to go fight a war, but it's meant to operate inside as that stand-in force. And so I've been starting to look at this, and I think it'll be curious to see how Marine Corps Aviation and the Air Force attack air, like your fighter community specifically, will start to, I think, blend a little bit as far as concepts work. And they start, I think there's going to be some crosstalk between the services as the Air Force has been doing ACE or trying to do ACE for about 4 or 5 years now. You know, it's had its own growing pain. So I would hope the Marine Corps is like, hey, give us all the your homework that you've already started doing and, you know, let's collaborate.
I would say to the Air Force's credit, you know, they really have been trying ACE operations and deployments out in the Pacific. I saw several of them while I was in command at Iwakuni on the Marine Corps side. That's all we do. is that kind of stuff. We are used to that. We send our squadrons all over the planet all of the time. You know, we have our unit deployment program where we're sending squadron, fixed wing, rotary wing, BMGR. So we're used to, you know, in the Air Force's term, the ACE movement already. We do that all the time. That's kind of bread and butter for us. And I would say probably the Air Force is anxious to learn from how does the Marine Corps do it and really how to reduce the footprint. Again, just from my experience, first ones that I saw coming out to Japan were quite large, very, very big for the amount of aircraft. And you're like, good Lord, that is a lot of folks and a lot of gear and a lot of logistics. But then the next one, it's a bit less, right? And so they're learning, hey, you know, we can get leaner in some areas.
Yeah, it's an interesting, not to get too off track with the Air Force stuff, but it's interesting the Air Force was designed generation ago to basically deploy in multiples of six. You would deploy with 6, 12, 18, and so on, aircraft, 24. But the first 12 would basically have all of the logistics footprint to enable the 18. So you just add, you know, add on top. So if you deployed six, you wouldn't have enough to really do anything. You'd have to rebuild a whole different force package. If you deployed 12, it would be really, really fat. If you deployed 18, it would get kind of where it needed to be. And then 24 was like, all right, we're lean, but now we have too many of everything. So there wasn't really a way to like scale with the size of the fleet. So I remember going to an exercise and it was like, I think five or six nations, a couple different services. And our squadron showed up and we had, I think, 12 jets and we had 300 maintainers plus all of our operation support and then our air crew. And then this other squadron shows up and they have 50 people. We're like, huh, look at that. Yeah. And you know, they stayed the whole time and they did their mission. Those guys were, you know, kicking butt. But yeah, it's when you, where can you cut? And again, every time you cut, there's always a choice and a risk and how you're organized and everything from even how people are trained. You know, if you're only trained to work on right-hand tools and right-hand screws, you can't, you're not trained on left-hand screws. You got a guy for that, the left-hand screw guy. And so by over-specializing, you actually inherently have to bring more people just because of how you're organized. So organized, trained, equipped, right? The Marine Corps, I'd be curious to see how the MOSs evolve to cover down on some of the more, especially in aircraft maintenance, you know, there's an MOS for everything in aircraft maintenance, where you have a hydraulic person can double as an airframer, et cetera. So I'd be curious to see how you manage the logistical footprint and the personnel footprint, really, when you're looking at Ford Ops for EBA.
Yeah, you're exactly right. And in aviation in particular, well, geez, I mean, look at the MLR, air defense, air surveillance, you know, rogue nemesis out there with sensors. And this is highly complex, technically intensive types of MOS skill set. This is not, hey, dude, here's your rifle and go point it that way and shoot that guy.
Oh, by the way, you still have to do that too.
You still have to do that too. Yep, absolutely. But that's the easy part almost. The hard part is the, you know, these highly technical skill sets and how do you cross train folks? You know, that is something that the Marine Corps is looking at as well. You know, in aviation in particular, gosh, F-35 is a very complicated animal. You talk avionics, engines, comm, nav, seats. I mean, those are, they're very, very good. Those airmen, those Marines, those sailors who do that work. But gosh, you go to month-long schools for that kind of stuff. It's hard to do OJT.
Oh, yeah. I remember, I'm reminded of a story at a base, a transit base, where there was two Marine Corps F-35s and two Air Force F-35s, and the Air Force F-35 needed servicing, and the Marine Corps maintenance guys are there. They're like, oh, you know, we can do it. You're like, yeah, like we're trained on it. You know, A's versus C's, but you know, that system is the same. And the Air Force is like, no, you're actually not allowed to touch our jet because like you're in the Marine Corps, you're not in the Air Force. Only the Air Force F-35 maintainers can touch it. I'm like, are you kidding me? Like, all right, you can sit there and, you know, not get help. So, yeah, I wouldn't let them work on it was either servicing or refueling. It was something very, very basic. Like
something very basic. It's the same exact system.
Yeah, you're wearing a different uniform. I don't trust you. So, Roger, let's talk about the Navy and how the Navy is going to support that mobility in the littorals. So we've been talking about the MLR and the Marine Corps, a lot about the Marine Corps, obviously, because Lance is our special guest today. But, well, what role does the Navy play and what are they doing differently?
Well, you know, that's a really interesting question because the Navy is a slightly different animal from any of the other services because we are much more platform centric than even the Air Force, because our platforms are so large. And everything that you guys have been talking about with this flexibility, on the one hand, is something the Navy already does really, really well internally to ships, for example, right? So guys on ships are cross-trained to do a lot of different jobs. But for the past probably 100 years or so, we have not done a really good job of scaling a force that can do exactly the types of things that you guys are discussing, right? So we've spent about 100 years talking about major blue water combat focused around carrier strike groups, carrier battle groups before that. And then we had amphibious ready groups, amphibious strike groups that we alluded to before. And we've not really had a modern, I'd say in the 21st century, cohesive plan to develop any of those ships. It's, you know, it's a very controversial and heated subject within the Navy, even before we talk about support to the Marine Corps or support with the Marine Corps, right? And I'll set aside all of the combatant arguments, because that's tangentially germane to this right now, because you need sea control. But for example, we can't even agree with the Marine Corps, which is our closest sister service, if you will, on the need for how many ships are we going to get to support this MLR. You know, I think
31 plus or minus one or two.
Yeah, right.
Hasn't changed in 20 years, turns out.
That's right. Yeah. Hasn't changed a whit. No.
Just the amphib side, but then you get into the, you know, how are we going to move this MLR around, right?
Right.
That sounds great that they're going to hold key maritime terrain and they're going to hold targets at risk. But you got to get them there and you got to move them place to place. So
you got to move
them places. That's not with the 31 amphibs.
That's right. Because the 31 amphibs right now are structured more as a break-in force than supporting what we're talking about here. And I think what we're going to see, and I don't have the answer, and I'll be honest, I don't think the Navy has the answer yet, because we're at an inflection point where we as a service are size centric as well as platform centric, right? So we don't do that 04 level of command, 03 level of command outside of aviation. I'll set naval aviation aside. I think they've done a very good job over the past 20 years becoming expeditionary. I mean, it's sort of commonplace now for a debt of planes to just hop off a carrier and go to a land base somewhere to support for whatever reason. In surface warfare, we have not done that at all. There's always been a big pushback against smaller ships, against smaller command sizes, driving command down to the 04 level, 03 level, which, you know, as I look at the MLR, Lance, I see a lot of requirement for junior leadership. I see a lot of requirement for agile decision making on the ground. And it's just going to be really tough for the Navy we have now to support this MLR. For a lot of the same reasons I think that we had problems supporting the anti-piracy mission about 10 or 12 years ago. And that's because the smallest ship we have is what we call a destroyer that would be a cruiser in most other navies. So, you know, it's interesting to me that the Marine Corps with this concept has come up with something that I think is very geared towards sea control. And the Navy does not seem to be gearing itself up to do its part. There's no better way to say it, to really do its part in sharing that sea control role.
But Roger, we're talking about littoral combat region in the Navy. Mm-hmm. Wasn't there a program called the Littoral Combat Ship? Wasn't it supposed to do that? What happened?
Oh, so there's the there's the spicy take, right? Do you guys go back far enough to remember the PCs and the hydrofoils before that? You were talking, Paco, earlier about how the Marine Corps is really, really good at setting a goal and being very public on grading itself. And, you know, and I don't get me wrong, I'm a very strong Navy supporter, but we are sort of the opposite of that. We don't do a very good job of defining requirements. Now, let me be very specific. Outside of what is seen as our post-World War II core mission, which is blue water sea control using a carrier strike group and all of the assets that will project power from that strike group or defend that strike group. So in that regard, I think we are fairly well positioned to deal with a blue water Chinese, well, pure Indo-Pacific threat.
Now, just real quick for the listeners, some people may say, but Roger, all the water's blue. So can you expand on that so everyone understands?
So in the Navy lexicon, blue water means open ocean, deep water, think middle of the Pacific, middle of the Atlantic. There's some nuance here. Green water, for a guy like me who did half his time expeditionary, there's a difference between green and brown water. Green is that sort of coastal region or the region in archipelagos, say Indonesia, the Philippines, that bridges a little bit of the blue water, green water. And then brown water tends to be rivers, large inland lake systems, so on and so forth. So great point, Paco, that we built a Navy to fight that deep water, open ocean fight. And what we're really talking about right now is containing the fight and maintaining the initiative against a peer adversary who, by nature of the geography, is going to fight in an archipelagic region. And we're not very well
prepared. I can't even pronounce to do that.
I was a little worried about saying it myself, but yeah.
No, I was going to say so blue water, brown water, and the green water, that I think that's good because we're really talking about the brown water. But back to what we were talking about earlier, like, well, how does everything just magically get there? Like, it requires transit across the blue water. And if your supply chains and you know, maritime transport logistics is all at risk from the time it leaves the dock, you know, it has to transit across the Pacific. You're not hiding, right? Everyone knows where the ships are at. With the sensors and space and stuff we have now, you're not hiding from anyone. So it just becomes an interesting problem stressing your supply chains and logistics across the tyranny of distance that is the Pacific. And then once you get there, now you're talking about distributing your forces, which is even another logistical problem. Everything is okay until you need to get resupplied. and then you have some issues. And the other thing, just to throw a curveball in, because we haven't given the Army, well, we gave the Army some credit. I didn't. I mean, Boyle did, but Boyle gave the Army a compliment earlier, and we haven't really talked about the Army at all. But the Army is actually the service charged with ship-to-shore movement. They have their own fleet of ships to move stuff to shore, but that's not the type of ship-to-shore movement that we're talking about in this case.
Correct. And worth mentioning, the Army actually has more hulls than the Navy, if you're just going to count them. The Army, to give credit, I think is starting to look at this pivot as well, and you could say that they have been for some time now as they went to the brigade combat team structure. But just this past week, as we're recording, they have been testing and just validated river bridging at the division level, which had always been a core capability. So one level up. But to your point, we need to get these forces to the fight. And that's, I think the Navy is right now very well positioned to do that. And where we seem to be falling down is that we're treating this like a zero-sum game. And I don't think we do as good a job as the Marine Corps has done in their force structure change within the Beltway of explaining why we don't need to trade some of our blue water capability for some green water capability here. We need to expand our capability because we can't afford to give away that ability to transit. Because as you said, the tyranny of distance across the Pacific, we have partner nations over there. We can't just withdraw behind our own borders. There's a whole other argument to be had there about civilian shipping and civilian shipbuilding and tonnage, but that's a debate for another day. But you're very correct that we need to get things to that first island chain, and we need to have ways to transship those things from blue water carriers to more of these green water platforms. And that's where, you know, Lance, I'd be interested to get your thoughts on what would appropriate Navy support look like from the MLR for the Marine Corps' point of view, because I have a vision as a former SWO and a historian of what fairly successful 100-year-old talking about war in the Pacific, what does that really look like? And there's a lot of things we can update for the modern era, talking about rocket artillery, right? That actually was a mainstay of how we supported the Marines. Everyone talks about the battleships. There were a plethora of rocket firing amphibs that would support the Marine Corps. I just use that as an example. But what in for myself, I think of small ships like a modern PT boat, if you will, a missile patrol craft that can help control the water between the islands. But we need to move those Marines between the islands. We need to do it quickly. We need to let you be very agile. And there's a lot of debate right now about, is that a Navy mission? Or I believe the Marine Corps is even talking about, is that something that you guys should be working on?
Yeah, so for the Marine Corps, you know, when we talk about moving the MLR inside the first island chain or side of a contested area, you know, in a contested environment is not a piece of gear. You know, the answer isn't a piece of gear. Certainly gear helps with that, but there's operational art that goes with it, which I think is what you're getting at, Roger. And there's a lot of different pieces of art, you know, that we can bring to bear and different concepts we can do. The physical aspect of it, you know, right now we don't have the shipping to be able to move the MLR around inside a contested area. Yes, we have organic assets in theater now, V-22s, C-130s, LCUs, LCACs, commercial shipping, as you mentioned. We do have amphibs, but as you said, Roger, that's more of a break-in force rather than a sustain force. But we'll use what we have on hand. And we feel, and this is something that the Marine Corps and the Navy have come up together, is the landing ship medium. It used to be the law, the land amphibious warship. Really, it's that ship that's going to move small pieces of the MLR around. Marine Corps, again, we've got a body of analysis. The U.S. Navy is starting to believe more and more as we, again, build the case for it. We do the analysis, we do the wargaming, we do the IPTs, we do the modeling and simulation, and the kind of missions that we might be asked to do. You know, we think the answer is 35 landing ship medium for that. But as you said, Roger, you know, the U.S. Navy has their priorities as well. You know, and if you went to Admiral Franchetti today and said, ma'am, you have $1 to spend on your future force today, you know, where is that dollar going to go? You know, what is the number one shipbuilding or modernization for the U.S. Navy? You know, you probably make a strong argument for its Columbia class submarines. Tough to argue. You know, the priorities of the U.S. Navy as a maritime force, although in alignment with the Marine Corps, they do have their own service priorities. But you're right. That is something that has not been worked out. And we go back to the beginning of the podcast where we talked about, hey, the Marine Corps came strong out of the gate and we're changing like mad and we're out ahead of everybody else. We're all the services. Well, this is one of the risks with it, is that we are not in lockstep with truly our sister service on where do we need to be and how do we make these operational concepts work? Because it will not work without the U.S. Navy. Paco, to your point, you know, with the U.S. Army, you know, that's part of their job as well. And so it's partnering with, you know, what kind of crafts do they have? But they're not kind of fit for purpose. They basically have a load of LCUs, you know, different flavors of them, different sizes, but basically it's an LCU. It's very, very hard when you're trying to convince another service, hey, Army, here's where you need to spend your money is on this kind of ship.
Yeah.
Or, hey, U.S. Navy, you need to go spend your money on this. You know, we've been arguing about amphibs. Like you said, Pago, I don't know what the answer is, but it's 31, you know. we've been having that internal debate, you know, for decades now about amphibs. And there's pros and cons with either side. But again, it's that landing ship medium that we feel needs to happen. And the Navy agrees, and they've agreed to buy some. Congress has agreed to fund. I apologize, I don't have the exact numbers off the top of my head.
No, that's okay. We can bring you back on. Episode 7, we're actually going to talk about future shipbuilding. I mean, we can just copy and paste some of this episode over.
This is great.
Yeah. It was almost like the long wind-up for the next episode, but it's not the next episode.
Yeah, for the future. I do want to mention, you know, Boyle, you were talking about operational art, and I think you're very correct there. It's interesting when you look at the different services and how we get to operational art, because my perception internally to the Navy is that sometimes we let our platforms drive our operational art rather than determining what our operational art planning is and then sourcing it with ships. But to your point, I think there needs to be a meeting of the minds between the Navy and the Marine Corps that I think we're working towards. I don't think it's quite there yet, that this MLR is a sea control asset for the Navy. Because I know some, you know, you talk to various different SWOs and what they think, some will think of this as a diversion of effort. And to my mind, these MLRs are really something that takes the place of some of these smaller ships in a way, because we can place the same effect on an island. We can place the same effect on a small piece of land. And if we can figure out how to be agile with it, we get the same benefit that we would have of creating one of these small ships that traditionally the U.S. Navy doesn't like to have. In the Cold War, our allies in Europe were going to provide those coastal patrol craft, and it's not really something we did. It's not in our current DNA. So I think that if we can really get the Navy and the Marine Corps team together to say the MLR is not a Marine Corps force, it's an American force that with the Navy is greater than the sum of its parts, that that's really where we need to be driving.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I have to say, when we brief our operational concepts to other services, to other senior leaders, to political leaders, you know, we are part of the naval force. It is not, hey, the Marine Corps is going to do this. Like, but as part of the naval force, the role of the Marine Corps is to do this, but it's just a role. It's a part of the larger whole.
Well, one of the good things about this, maybe, we'll see, Admiral Grady, who's the vice chairman of the Joint Chiefs, he's been throwing sharp elbows the past year or so trying to restore power of the JROC, the Joint Requirements Oversight Council. And that's the one that facilitates the requirements coordination. And ultimately, they control the money for requirements. And so when you want to force jointness and a joint decision, that's usually the clearinghouse that does it. And that's supposed to be aligned with the joint warfighting concept 3.0, which then is now into some other operating concepts that aren't available on Google. I remain positive that there is a way forward, and I think people are starting to align. When you have interdependencies like what we've been talking about, there has to be a way to facilitate jointness, organize, train, and equip across the different services. Turns out, there's a big building with five sides in Washington, D.C. A lot of smart people work there, fine Americans. They really do care. So, Boyle, what are we missing? What haven't we touched on yet that you'd like to remind us of? Or what are we missing? It's got to be something.
Let's see. I would just like to maybe double down on that, you know, how the Marine Corps has changed, you know, how we see the future. You don't get a lot of head shakes from the other services. When you go and you brief them, you talk to them about it, and you're letting them know, you know, what the Marine Corps provides, but it is that sense, make sense, counter sense, and be the, basically be the JTAC for the joint force. That is how the Marine Corps kind of sees this role with the MLR. We're there in the WES, in the first island chain, time now, ready to enable the joint force should anything happen. Because we are doing that, because we enable such a powerful U.S. joint force, you know, that provides the deterrent effect. We don't want to execute this. You know, nobody does. But should we need to, you know, we are working towards our manning, training, and equipping of that. Partner with the joint force, partner with the Navy, with the Air Force, with the Army, and figure out what are the best concepts. Marine Corps is just one piece of that.
Well said. Peace through strength. Strength requires deterrence. Deterrence requires credibility. Credibility requires a well, thoughtful, organized, trained, and equipped force. So,
Colonel, that was way Lance... smarter than what I said.
I had a chance to think about it while you're talking. I'm like, oh yeah, they're kind of all connected. How about that? Turns out they're all connected. So, Marine Corps Colonel Lance Boyle Lewis, thank you for joining us. And Roger, thanks for pitching in the fight to bring the Navy perspective. Really do appreciate it. Our next episode is going to kick off phase two of this series, the tactical technology that's going to be in play once we figured out access and mobility to the areas of operations. So we've been talking ships and Marines for the past few episodes. The next episode is in my wheelhouse because we're going to be talking about the fighter force structure of the future. So with that being said, stay on Freak. This is Future War. Thanks.
I hope you found Phase 1 of On Future War illuminating and thought-provoking. As a brief recap, Phase 1 focused on operational mobility, the challenges surrounding projecting power into the Western Pacific, the threats posed by potential peer competitors, particularly the People's Republic of China, and their tactics and technology, and ongoing efforts, particularly on the part of the U.S. Marine Corps, to adapt structures and strategies to overcome those threats and prevail in potential future conflict especially in a littoral or archipelagic environment. Phase 2 will begin discussing technology on the tactical level, specifically 5th-gen and future aircraft, drones, and unmanned aerial systems, and the demand for as well as vulnerabilities to GPS as it relates to modern combat systems. That begins next month with Mike Paco Benitez and Andrew Scar Van Timmerman in Episode 4, 5th-gen Technology and the High-Low Mix. If you've enjoyed this program, you can find additional commentary, interviews, and in-depth series on current affairs and military aviation at Authentic Media on YouTube or on your podcast provider of choice. On Future War is brought to you through partnership with Cubic Defense. For over 50 years, Cubic has been facilitating warfighter readiness to prevail on night one and beyond.